Welcome, everyone. My name is Eric Jorgensen. I'm the founder of Special Needs Navigator. For those of you who are not familiar with Special Needs Navigator, I started Special Needs Navigator because as a parent, I was tired of not getting straight answers. So my focus is helping families navigate the maze of benefits, resources, and services. Today, I have with us Amanda Garzon. She is the National Director of Program Services and Communications with the Hydrocephalus Association. I would categorize it as a service for families. I'm going to let Amanda do a deeper dive into what hydrocephalus is because, frankly, I'm still learning and I'm really excited to talk with Amanda today. Some professional background about Amanda is she has served as Director of Operations for iConstituent, which was a software firm specializing in communications and database solutions, particularly for members of Congress. She holds a Bachelor's of Arts in Political Science from a college I can't pronounce, and a Master's in International Affairs from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. And Amanda and I were talking before we recorded, and she will be sharing her personal experience with hydrocephalus. I think it's really impactful when you understand, like I just learned, it can affect anybody and at any time. So many of us parents like myself, we have a child who was born with it, and it's not something the child is going to develop later in life. Like Down syndrome and autism, you either have it or you don't. It's not something you're going to grow into or you may get as you get older. What Amanda's going to share with you, it's pretty shocking just how potentially you could be affected. Amanda and I could be talking now, 10, 15 years from now, and ourselves could be affected by hydrocephalus as I understand it. So I've done enough talking. Amanda, welcome. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Please give us a little bit more personal background, how you came to be with Hydrocephalus Association, what your ties are with hydrocephalus. And I'm going to do something a little unique. I want you to present your slides because I think it's so important for people to understand what hydrocephalus is.
Absolutely. No, and I love being here. Thank you so much, Eric. For those of you watching, Eric and I got to meet a couple of years ago when he actually came and spoke to one of our local support groups here in the Washington, D.C. area about his services and what parents need to think about when they're doing their financial planning and even kind of life planning in general and the different options that there are out there. And I think it was one of our most popular meetings by far. I mean, it was fantastic. So I'm going to get Eric to come back again this year and I'm super excited. But I think, Eric, that was probably your first time hearing the word hydrocephalus, and it is an invisible condition. Not a lot of people know about it. I started working at HA 8 years ago, and I do have a personal connection to that. I had been in the nonprofit world, as Eric mentioned. I went to Bryn Mawr College, which is a women's college outside of Philadelphia, before I went up to New York City. So there you go. Don't ever forget that, Eric, because you'll make a lot of women angry. But, you know, I decided to leave the for-profit world because I just didn't feel like I was living my life's mission. I have always wanted to help people. My degrees were all focused on nonprofit work, particularly abroad. And, you know, my life shifted when I had my daughter, Gabby. So I am so blessed that I get to be at the Hydrocephalus Association now. And so Eric kind of did talk about this. And this is a picture of my daughter when she was born. So my daughter was born 3 months prematurely. She weighed just under 2 pounds. I could hold her in my hand. She, like many premature babies, had a brain bleed that damaged the tissue that helped circulate as well as absorb fluid in the brain. And so she developed hydrocephalus. We spent 96 days in the neonatal intensive care unit. She had 7 brain surgeries in the first 7 months of her life to place 2 shunts, which I'll tell you about in a couple minutes, into her brain that drained fluid from her brain into her abdominal cavity.
I want people to think about that. 96 days.
It was a full-time job, Eric. I like literally would get up in the morning, I'd get dressed, and I would walk to the NICU, and I would spend the entire day in the NICU with my daughter, and I would go home at night. And oftentimes I would sneak down again, like at around 10 at night, because parents were allowed in all the time to be with her. It was a very scary time.
And then 7 brain surgeries.
In the first 7.
On top of that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and a seizure condition. I didn't mention that. And there's a lot of things for those of you watching who did NICU time, as I like to call it. You know, the 2 steps forward, 1 step back that my family went through with Gabby in the NICU. So there are so many other things, medical things that get thrown at you in the neonatal intensive care unit. So 7 brain surgeries was just one piece of it, but the biggest piece of it. So She is now 20 years old. We did grow up, right? She has had 18 brain surgeries, our most recent, the Friday before Christmas at Hopkins a year ago. So not this past Christmas, but the year before that. And she spent 2 weeks actually at Hopkins as they drained fluid from her brain onto poles on IV racks and pumped her body with antibiotics before they placed her new shunts that now this one actually drains fluid into her heart. And we'll talk about the different configurations for the medical device that treats hydrocephalus. And over the course of her life, we've spent a lot of time in ERs and hospitals, which is why I'm so grateful that I'm having this opportunity to share our experience today. You know, she graduated from public high school here in Montgomery County, Maryland, and just started college this week, remote learning. So it is our journey.
And for some families, Amanda, is it unreasonable to think there might be further complications in the form of developmental disabilities or, you know, some kind of a learning disability? I mean, when you're operating on the brain that often, I feel like there's going to be the potential for consequences, right? I mean,
absolutely. And in fact, let's talk about what hydrocephalus is. Let's deep dive into that, Eric, for a second. And then we can talk about what it is like to live with the condition and what that means for families. As you guys can probably guess, when I was first given the diagnosis for hydrocephalus, I was like, a hydro what? I couldn't even say the word, but it is hydrocephalus. It comes from the Greek, hydro meaning water, cephalus meaning head. So what is hydrocephalus? Hydrocephalus is an invisible condition, right? You saw the pictures of my daughter. You don't see hydrocephalus necessarily. It is a chronic neurological condition where there is an imbalance between how much cerebrospinal fluid is produced in the brain and how much is absorbed. So as the cerebrospinal fluid builds up, it causes the ventricles, which is on the screen you're seeing, it's that big blue, dark blue area in the middle of the brain. It causes them to enlarge and to put pressure on the brain as if the brain's being pushed into the side of the skull. And there is no cure for hydrocephalus, and it can be fatal. So on the right, you see what a normal brain looks like, and then you can see how big those ventricles can get on the right-hand side. That is what hydrocephalus is. Eric alluded to this too. Who develops hydrocephalus, right? So who's at risk for developing hydrocephalus? You know, not to scare you guys, but anyone at any time can develop hydrocephalus. And it's often thought of as a pediatric condition. And with babies, what we often see is that you can develop it in utero. So you can be born with it, but you can develop it after birth from a brain bleed, which is what happened with my daughter. But, you know, it can also develop from a head injury. So a soldier, you know, who was in Afghanistan. I know a couple of members of our military who returned from Afghanistan who had developed hydrocephalus. I have a friend who was hit in the head with a baseball when he was 10 years old, and he had a brain bleed, and that caused hydrocephalus. You can develop it from a tumor, so brain cancer or a tumor in the brain. An infection, that's where we see a lot of high rates of hydrocephalus in Africa, for example. So in areas where there is heavy rainfall and a lot of different infections and different living conditions. But even in the US, right, you can get an infection in your brain. And then you can develop it for unknown reasons as part of the aging process. And they just really don't know why it develops in those cases. And it impacts people ages 65 and older, and it's called normal pressure hydrocephalus. Some other medical conditions that result in hydrocephalus that may sound familiar to some of you watching are spina bifida. So 80% of people with spina bifida have hydrocephalus. Only about 10% of people with hydrocephalus, though, have spina bifida. So it's just a portion of our population. Dandy Walker syndrome and Chiari malformation. So those are some other conditions that can cause hydrocephalus. You know, how is hydrocephalus diagnosed? So usually it's from clinical observation. So parents, you know, with babies might see their child's head getting bigger. You know, Eric, we talked about this when we first met. A lot of parents who might be watching this, you know, when you take your child to those wellness checks and they measure their head, well, one of the things they're checking for is that their head is not enlarging and showing signs of congenital hydrocephalus that might have developed in utero and was slow to form after they were born. But irritability, fussiness, fever, that fontanelle area that's pulsating a lot and looks enlarged or is bulging. For adults, it'll tend to be really severe headaches, visual challenges, walking challenges, urinary urgency. And particularly in the senior population, it looks very similar to dementia. So there'll be like memory issues and things like that. I mean, clearly, right when they do those clinical observations, they rush somebody in for an MRI or a CT scan. And that's what you're seeing right here, Eric, is you're seeing a scan of somebody and you're seeing those enlarged ventricles.
In the senior population, I mean, I think with people our age or younger, I think they're quicker to do these MRIs, right? But with the seniors, how do you stop them from just defaulting to saying, oh, you're getting dementia? Because there's so many different kinds of dementia. It's not just Alzheimer's, right? So how do you get them to say, well, let's do an MRI to rule out hydrocephalus? Is that something families should be advocating for?
Absolutely. And so it is actually really a challenge. And we get phone calls all the time at the Hydrocephalus Association from seniors or loved ones who are caring for somebody who's showing severe signs of decline. And they've been sent from one doctor to another doctor to another doctor, and nobody is thinking hydrocephalus. They don't know about normal pressure hydrocephalus. So one of the challenges that the Hydrocephalus Association is facing and are trying to change is educating better the adult neurological and neurosurgical populations about proper diagnosis of normal pressure hydrocephalus, making sure it's part of their protocol to rule out when they're doing the whole list of what could be affecting this person. The challenge is somebody might not make it to a neuro person for a long time, right? Because their general practitioner or their family doctor will not know what normal pressure hydrocephalus is. So they'll be running all these different tests. And then maybe they'll send them to endocrinology, or maybe they'll send them to physical therapy or rehab. So there's like this delay in finally getting somebody to a neurologist or a neurosurgeon who would pick up on it more quickly. And so that's what we see a lot in the normal pressure hydrocephalus population. So certainly advocating to get that referral out to neurology or neurosurgery more quickly is what I would suggest to families.
Cool.
And then the last test that they'll do, and this is typically on adults or on seniors, is a lumbar puncture or a lumbar drainage to assess like how much relief somebody's going to get when they remove fluid from the system, from the CSF system. And that can also predict for seniors how well they're going to respond to treatment. Because if they can remove fluid, and I've seen this, it's crazy. Somebody will go in and they can't walk. They do this thing called it's like a shuffle. Because it feels like for a person with normal pressure hydrocephalus, like their feet are magnetized to the floor. So they do this little shuffle. You can go to our YouTube channel. We have a video of it. And I've seen the fluid be taken off of them and they walk normally down the hallway. It can be that immediate, you know, being able to assess how much that fluid is interrupting, you know, normal activity.
How quickly will you notice somebody's decline? With dementia, from what I've personally experienced with family members, it's not like flipping a switch and suddenly somebody just has reduced mental capacity, right? It's gradual. Is it similar with normal pressure? I mean, because it just takes time for that fluid to build up. And then by the time it's built up, it's...
Yes, exactly. Now you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, it would be a gradual decline. And the three symptoms, so this is what we always tell individuals who are worried about an older loved one, the three predominant symptoms for normal pressure hydrocephalus are the gait that I mentioned. So it's starting to see them having challenges walking. And again, if you know to ask for, you know, mom, dad, does it feel like your feet are kind of stuck to the floor a little bit? Like you're having a hard time lifting your feet up? That's a really good indicator. Urinary urgency is a really great indicator. It's one of the two, so there's a triad of symptoms. And then the last one is...
Real quick with the urgency, Amanda, is that they actually have to go or they just always feel like they have to go?
Both. Initially, it'll be like they feel like they have to go and then they can't hold it, right? And then it becomes full-on incontinence. So, and then the last one is those dementia-type symptoms, you know, confusion, memory issues, things like that. Normal pressure hydrocephalus is often misdiagnosed as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. And so it's important to ask a doctor who's working with your family, could this be normal pressure hydrocephalus? Have you ruled this out before we automatically assume that it's Alzheimer's or Parkinson's?
Well, in Alzheimer's, there are no tests for. I mean, you don't definitively until the person dies, typically. In Parkinson's, I think it's very similar, right? It's you rule out everything else, and it must be either Alzheimer's or Parkinson's because there's nothing else to diagnose.
But they need to rule everything out, right? That's the thing. And so if they haven't done a brain image, if they haven't seen if the ventricles are enlarged, right, then they haven't ruled everything out.
And I'm going to put these three things to look for. I'll make sure I have those in the show notes.
Yeah, there is a funny joke in the senior community. They call it wet, wacky, and wobbly. That's how they refer to it. I think it's great. Wet, wacky, and wobbly. It's easy to remember, right? The triad of symptoms. So there you go. You want to know how hydrocephalus is treated, Eric? Because this is going to shock you.
Yes. Is that or I have to keep myself muted and stop laughing?
So as I mentioned, there's no cure for hydrocephalus, and the only treatment for hydrocephalus is brain surgery. There's no medicine that you can take. There's nothing except for brain surgery. And brain surgery, the most common treatment for hydrocephalus is the placement of a medical device called a shunt that drains fluid from the brain to another part of the body. So they have to drill into your skull. So if you look, you can see on the slide, entry into the cranium, they drill a little hole. They literally stick a tube through your brain into the middle of your brain, into that central area where the fluid accumulates in the ventricles. And that tube is then attached to a valve, which controls how much fluid can leave your brain at any given time. And all of that runs down underneath the skin. So it's all under the skin. It runs down underneath the skin and it is either placed into the abdominal cavity, so not the stomach itself, but into the abdominal cavity or into the right atrium of the heart, into one of the main vessels feeding going into the heart.
I want to highlight here and stop you real quick, Amanda, because absolutely. As adults, okay, sure, you put some tubing in, you know, whatever, right? But when you do that with a child, especially a young child who's growing, you've got to think there's going to be challenges there because they're not going to want to go in every 6 months to a year to redo it, right? So, right. I mean, and you have personal experience with this.
Yeah, that's what they used to do in the old days, right? Like, so it used to be that they would put the tubing in and it would, you know, be measured, you know, maybe a little bit longer, but so it might give them a little bit of growth room, but, you know, they would keep going back in and changing that tubing. And the way that they do that is they literally put the tubing on the end of like a needle that they basically jam underneath in that soft, fatty tissue under the skin. And it's really painful. I've had people who have hydrocephalus tell me that, you know, replacing that part of the tubing over the part in their brain is so much worse. Like they're just like, because it's really painful. When my daughter had her shunts, and remember she had two because she needed one on each side because her ventricles weren't communicating. There wasn't flow between the two ventricles. She had like 8 feet of tubing wrapped in her abdominal cavity. So 4 on each side. And what that meant was that even though she had a number of brain surgeries, they were just replacing the part in her brain. They didn't have to touch the part going to her abdominal cavity. And as she grew, it just kind of stretched out. Now that tubing can calcify over time. And you'll see that in a lot of like older teenage patients, young adults, where they've had the same tubing for the course of their life, it's kind of hardened, then it cracks or breaks. And so they have to get it replaced. So, you know, that can happen over time. But I do think putting that extra tubing into the abdominal cavity, you know, their goal is to minimize the number of times they have to open up the system and do surgery, not only because who wants to have brain surgery or surgery where they're placing running tube under your skin? Nobody. But also because the more times you open up that system, you're exposing it to infection. An infection of your brain is very serious. It can cause permanent brain damage. And so they're always trying to minimize the exposure to the brain, to the outside world. So the fun, not so fun thing is like if you do get a brain infection and they do need to remove that tubing in your brain, they literally stick tubing in your brain and it's just coming out of your head. Call it the unicorn. And you have like this tube and stick coming out of your head. It's measuring the pressure inside your brain. It's feeding antibiotics directly into your brain and it's removing fluid. That's like a fun game that we get to play every once in a while. Not fun. And it's, you know, imagine just sitting in bed with this tubing coming out of your brain, putting fluid in a bag next to you. It's crazy, right?
I mean, how scary would it be just for a young child or even a teenager, right? To be told, we have to be very careful for how you sleep. I know I tend to toss and turn. So, I mean, just wow, no.
You're okay sleeping. You have to be careful. Like, you're not going to play soccer. Right? Like little kids can start playing soccer, but the minute you get into competitive soccer where you're heading the ball and stuff, that's not an option anymore for kids with hydrocephalus. We have a lot of swimmers. We have a lot of kids who are in the arts, great singers, musicians, but you're not playing contact sports, right? You're not doing that.
Yeah, you've got to be very careful. And I don't want to make it sound like you're made of glass, but it doesn't sound like you can be doing very, very physical sports. I mean, not just contact sports, like football and stuff like that. But I mean, even baseball, I would worry about getting hit by a ball or something. I mean,
yeah. And we do have some baseball players. You are wearing a helmet. You're certainly taking more of a risk, right? And neurosurgeons are, you know, monitor their patients very carefully and make a plan for their patients around what they feel comfortable allowing their patients to do and encouraging them not to do. There isn't actually consistency across the neurosurgical, particularly, you know, even in the pediatric neurosurgical world, you know, so I know some patients who will ride roller coasters and other doctors who are like, no, you can't ride roller coasters. You know, it depends. Of course, I also know a woman who has normal pressure hydrocephalus in her mid-60s who went skydiving 2 years ago to raise awareness about hydrocephalus. So
I won't go skydiving and I don't have hydrocephalus.
I know. But you know, you talk about the shunt and how much does the shunt interfere with people's lives. I do want to just mention there is one other treatment option. And this was probably the biggest advancement we've had because really when you think about it, you know, it's pretty medieval what they're doing, right? They're jamming tubing underneath the skin going down to the abdominal cavity, or they're putting it into the heart and they're drilling a hole in the skull and then they're putting a tube in the brain. It's like glorified plumbing, right? Yeah. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's not incredibly sophisticated. but the treatment in overall, there is some sophistication within some of the mechanisms, but there is another form of treatment called an endoscopic third ventriculostomy. I'll pay you $20 if you can say that 5 times really fast. And that is basically where you can see the endoscope on the screen. They take that hard device and it's got a camera on the end of it. And again, they have to drill a hole. They poke through the brain into the ventricular space down through the base of the third ventricle. And you're seeing that ETV site, and they poke a hole outside of the ventricle system to kind of open the ventricle system to the rest of the fluid system. And it basically creates a natural passageway to release fluid outside of the ventricles where it's trapped. And so people who have successful ETVs do not need shunts. But just like shunts failing at any moment, an ETV can close. So you're never out of the window of living with a condition where you never know if you're going to need to go in for brain surgery. So the shunt has one of the highest failure rates of any medical device on the market, which is why so many people have to have repeat brain surgeries. You know, I think the body, particularly for young children, is fighting against this foreign object that's in there. You get tissue growth on the end of the tubing in the brain that's trying to let fluid out, so it's getting clogged up. And so, you know, in general, I have a friend who's had 111 brain surgeries. My daughter's lucky. She's only had 18. And the fact that I can say my daughter's lucky for only having 18 brain surgeries is in and of itself psychologically not okay, right? Like there's something wrong with that statement that, you know, I'm happy that she's only had 18 brain surgeries, but you know, the shunt fails. And so we have this great alternative, the ETV, but the ETV also fails. And so I know we're going to talk about in a second, what is it like to actually live with the condition? There's a lot of mental health issues around living with the condition where you never know if you're okay.
And I want to remind people, because we've gone into a lot about what hydrocephalus is, and I want to remind people, you're here because you represent the Hydrocephalus Association to try to change all of this,
yes,
to try to raise money to get some new ways of solving this problem. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know if you've already said it, but I remember you and I were talking, and this is more prevalent than Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or some of these other disabilities that individuals are born with.
That are more better known than our condition is. And there's actually the thing that's interesting. You brought this up earlier. We're talking about the brain, right? So there's downstream effects of having a neurological condition like hydrocephalus. First of all, if you've had a brain bleed, there's been some injury to your brain from the bleed itself. It's developed hydrocephalus, but there's also other injuries that have happened. For children whose brains are under such incredible pressure from the fluid building up, there's long-term implications of brain changes with that as well. So for example, the nerve that connects the right and the left hemispheres for my daughter, that has been shortened because her brain was under so much pressure. She had so much fluid as a baby. It didn't develop fully, right? And so what are like some of the outcomes for people who are living with hydrocephalus? And these are all people who have hydrocephalus, except for the top right picture, only the woman on the far right, the blonde in the tank top with the design on it. She has hydrocephalus. The rest of us are all hydro moms in that picture, but everybody else has hydrocephalus in this picture. What is it like to live with the condition? So for seniors who develop normal pressure hydrocephalus, the majority of them, once they're treated, properly diagnosed and treated, they see their symptoms reverse. And so you hear wonderful stories of individuals getting their lives back, coming out of retirement if they had to retire early. And so it's often referred to in the press as the reversible dementia. And even I think the Alzheimer's Association on its website kind of talks about it that way. I'm not quite sure. It might be AARP. But for children who develop hydrocephalus at an early age, the road can be very different and much harder over the course of their life. So it can include learning disabilities, visual challenges, right? It's the brain, as that pressure in the brain is putting pressure on the optic nerves. So it can cause blindness as well. Chronic headaches, chronic pain, certainly mental health challenges brought on by living with a medical condition where at any time they can be rushed in for brain surgery with no warning. Doesn't matter if it's your prom, doesn't matter if you're taking the AP exams or the bar exam to become a lawyer, you know, you get a headache. It gets worse and worse and worse. You're going into the hospital and you might be having brain surgery an hour later. You really don't know. And so for children, the road can be very different. And those challenges will also follow them into adulthood, which can, of course, impact their ability in the workplace to thrive and their ability to make and sustain personal relationships. We also have a lot of comorbidities, Eric. And this is how I think you and I, when we first met, connected. 40% of people with hydrocephalus have seizure conditions. We also have a high comorbidity rate with autism, ADHD, executive function challenges, cerebral palsy. So again, as you mentioned, it's the brain, right? And so there can be a lot of downstream impacts of damage or malformation during development in utero that can impact somebody's life.
Well, there's other things I think people may not be thinking of when they're listening to you. It's also, you've got to think about where you're going to live, right? You can't go live on a farm an hour away from a hospital. Even then, if you are near a hospital, is it a big hospital or more of a rural kind of broken bone hospital? I mean, nothing against those hospitals, but personal bias. I wouldn't want to be going to a hospital where I might be the first hydrocephalus case somebody has seen.
Yes.
When I had my cancer, I opted to go to Hopkins because I wanted to go to a doctor who is, this is all they do, right? I mean, this is, my surgeon was, what her focus was face and head, face and scalp melanomas. If that's all she does, I'm not as concerned as going to a hospital or a teaching hospital where, oh, you know, I think I'm familiar with melanoma. I know what the texts say to do. Well, no. So all that to say, same thing with hydrocephalus, right? I mean, there's going to be doctors. Your daughter's had 18, your friend's had 111. I want to take my kid to a doctor. That's their Monday. You know what I mean? Like they've just, oh yeah, I did 12 surgeries yesterday. Not the guy that goes, oh, I did 2 surgeries last year.
Right.
You know, I mean, so that's something I think families need to be thinking about when they have a child with that diagnosis, whether it comes later in life because of a sports injury or a car accident or TBI coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan. You need to make sure you're putting yourself in a situation, I would think, that you're going to live near a major hospital.
Absolutely. You have to have access to a major institution that can manage your hydrocephalus. So that means neurosurgery and also neurology, most likely. And it's something we think about all the time. Like, where are kids going to go to school? Okay, well, you know, that college is not necessarily an option because you're not close enough to somewhere where if you needed to get someplace quickly, they could take care of you. It impacts where we vacation, right? You know, one of the reasons that, you know, I came out of tech, you mentioned that I had previously worked up for a tech company called iConstituent. And so when I got here, I brought my tech background with me, clearly, obviously. And so I developed an app that families can use to basically have a record of their treatment and their latest images so that when they are traveling, they have the ability to show someone an up-to-date medical record. So, you know, I've taken my daughter to Mexico. We went to Morocco. Of course, when I went to Morocco, I had all that information with me so that if we had to go to the hospital, we knew where to go. And I knew where the hospital was, you know, like I knew where we were going. And one of the things the Hydrocephalus Association does is help families navigate that. You know, I had a friend who was vacationing in Italy with their daughter and she went, it looked like she was going into shunt failure. And we immediately were able to connect her with a local neurosurgeon who knows hydrocephalus. You know, the neurosurgical community is small globally, and the people who are interested and invested in hydrocephalus is even smaller. And we have very good connections, you know, globally to who those individuals are. But yes, you're thinking about it all the time, and it definitely impacts the decisions you make in your life.
In your case, you've had it since your daughter was born. And in some ways, I think it's almost a little easier because it just became part of your lifestyle, right? I mean, yeah. You don't know anything else. And I'm not making light. I'm not. But I'm thinking.
You're right.
I'm thinking of new families that, because like you, to your point earlier, and we've stressed this over and over, it can come up at any time. Mm-hmm. If you're suddenly impacted, and this is where me being in the military comes back, because I have friends that were literally blown up, you know, and they come back with TBIs. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a stretch to say, you know, you get hit by an RPG, bang your head around, you come home. There's a good potential for hydrocephalus or other issues. So it can really be a game changer to have to rethink and replan your life. And I don't want people thinking that I'm saying you can't live a life. I mean, Amanda, I think you've done a great job highlighting that people can still do things. You took your daughter to Morocco. I mean, there's still stuff you can do. You just have to be a little more careful. Yeah. So I want to make sure I include the app in the show notes. Because I want to make sure people have access to it. But they also, this is why you exist, right? I mean, this is why Hydrocephalus Association exists.
Absolutely.
Make sure people know they're not alone. Yep. There are tons of resources. There are tons of people you can talk to, like, maybe not tons, but there's a lot of people like them that they can talk to that have already gone that route. Yeah. You know, when you're encountering something, you're probably not the first person that's ever had to come across and solve this. And even if you are, there's probably a group of people that you can lean on that you don't have to do it alone.
That is one of our key messages, right? And in fact, I think it's on our literature, like the literature that we give to families who've been newly diagnosed that they'll give out in doctor's offices. You are not alone. And the reason that that is so prominent on our literature is that hydrocephalus is a very lonely condition. because you can't see it and people don't assume anything's wrong with you, right? And the spectrum of hydrocephalus can be very wide, right? So you can have an individual with hydrocephalus who is pretty physically and cognitively challenged by the condition, all the way to somebody who's maybe had one shunt surgery, their initial placement, maybe one revision, and they are, you know, leading an incredibly successful professional life, married, children, you know, and are very minimally impacted by hydrocephalus. And then there's everybody in between, right? There's everybody in between. And a lot of how the condition impacts your life is how you developed it and why, and then how many times your brain has had to be assaulted over the course of the treatment, over the course of your lifetime. So it also is what makes it really challenging, right? Because people can know someone with hydrocephalus and be like, oh, but they're fine, like, you know? But yeah, but somebody else isn't, right? There was a study that was done, it's old now. And one of the reasons we actually started a patient registry to start to try and find trends across our community, there was no patient registry in the country at all. And so it's not mandated reporting. It's not housed by the CDC. I wish that we had mandated reporting so that we could actually really understand every person who has hydrocephalus in the country. It's opt-in. So we ask people to join so we can start to see trends. So we know what we need to do as an association to provide the right resources, but also so our scientists understand where to focus their research studies. But we're starting to like learn more about the condition that we just really never knew about. It is a really nuanced and complex condition. People treated it as if it was so simple. Like I said, that glorified plumbing. That's really not the case. And that is really because prior to the early 1960s, when the shunt was brought commercially to market and really used widely, people were dying. So we didn't see adults growing into adulthood. We didn't know what it looked like. Seniors were being misdiagnosed. They were probably in nursing homes, you know, because nobody knew that they had hydrocephalus. So, you know, it wasn't really until relatively recently in our history, right? I mean, certainly in our lifetime era, that we've seen hydrocephalus, you know, over the age range now as well, right? Because people are growing up with it. So it's been interesting for me to, even in my time, my 8 years at the association, to see how much we've learned over time and to make sure that we're providing the resources, because it is an incredibly lonely condition. Even for the people who don't have a lot going on with it, it's still nice to know that you're not the only one who's got this tube that's draining fluid into your abdomen.
I just think about, you want to be around people that are like you.
Yeah.
And to your point about it being lonely, Amanda, I mean, I can only imagine walking around wondering, you know, who else do you have that can relate to? I can almost picture the individuals affected, and this is my morbid sense of humor, but individuals comparing, oh, you've only had 40 surgeries.
I do it all the time. I'll go down your morbid path for a second too. There was a group of moms and we wanted to put together a funny like YouTube type, you know, show, just like the funny stuff that we say all the time, because, you know, we'll be together. And we were actually all, a bunch of us were together. And one of our friends, her husband called, like we're all out of town together in North Carolina. And her husband calls from New York. I think our son's in shunt failure. And, you know, so she's on the phone and we all know what the call is, because she's like, and we're like, oh my God, you know, shunt failure, here we go. You know, we have to get her on an airplane so she can get back up there. And she's like, okay, what you need to do is you need to take him to the doctor, blah, 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 blah. So like after about an hour and a half of him calling and, you know, taking him into the doctor, they're doing all these different tests, you know, whatever. It turns out he has strep, right? And we're all like, yes, he has strep. That's so awesome. We're like, literally we're drinking in a bar. So we're like cheering or like doing like, cheers, it's strep. And I think people in the bar were like, why are they cheering that, you know, like this kid has strep? That's horrible. We're like, oh my God, you just so don't get it. Like, you know, is it brain surgery? And now, so there we go. Strep, awesome. You know, I always felt like, you know, with my second child, she had to be like bleeding profusely on the floor or something. You know, if it was like, you know, you fell down, get up, you're fine. Let's go. Come on. Everything's in perspective when you've had a child who's been in the hospital as much as our kids have, and, you know, have had so many brain surgeries, and, you know, and that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with something as big and as grave as brain surgery. But if we didn't laugh about it, it would consume us, because it is terrifying, you know. And when you bring in some of the other parts of hydrocephalus that can happen, like the seizures, it's not fun. It's not fun at all. It's not.
I really appreciate you sharing all of this, because there's so many people out there, I think, that just have no clue. And I think, I mean, this audience, the audience that's watching and listening to us, they're families whose children have disabilities anyway. So to some degree, many of these families are going through their own challenges. Maybe it's self-injurious behaviors, or it's intellectual disabilities where the child is just not getting beyond a certain milestone. So they get it, right? I mean, at the very least, these families understand, hey, there are parents out there. I'm not a big believer in saying something's worse or better than somebody else. I mean, I think
it's different.
Yes.
We're all on our journey.
Right. And I mean, you know, you don't know how much bandwidth somebody has. You know, I certainly had my challenges over the last, 8 years, right? But I'm not going to say I've been through any more hell or any less hell than somebody else. What I will tell you is I've gotten really good at laughing about it.
You have to, or it just pulls you under. I think the reason I had mentioned the registry and I had lost my train of thought because I started going down the morbid road with you was there was a study about a long time ago now, like 12 years ago. Don't like the 90s feel like yesterday, Eric? Anyway, and I think this was actually in the late 80s. And it said that 60% of children growing into adulthood with hydrocephalus will not be independent, will not grow up to live independently. And I was like, no, I refuse to believe that. And so, you know, so many of us moms, you know, and dads and caregivers are trying to do as much as we can to be those advocates in school, to work with executive function coaches, to understand what does executive function really mean, to then help our kids start to learn how to become as independent as possible, use technology to help themselves, to not be afraid to talk about who they are and what they need. And it's all really hard, right? It's all really hard. What teenager wants to say, you know, oh yeah, I have this brain condition? Nobody wants, they just don't want to say that. So, you know, when I heard that news, I was like, no. And then I was also like, but I also don't know if that's really true. And that was kind of one of the reasons why we started the registry, because we realized there's so much we don't know about our own patient population. Is it really true that 60% aren't going to live independently? I don't know. Like, let's see. Let's survey people, you know? So I am really looking forward to seeing what the registry starts to bring out. We're close to our first 1,000 patients and we'll write our first paper once we hit 1,000. So it'll be good.
Is that another way we can help you is by people watching this, if they're affected by hydrocephalus, yes, or they know somebody who's affected, take part in the registry and they can go to your website for that. They can go to, yes, the hydrocephalus.
And I'll send you that link and everything, it's de-identified. So the scientists who are looking at the information, they don't know who anybody is. They're just looking at large trends across the patient population. So your data is safe. Your identity is safe. We strip it all out. It's stored at the University of Utah. It's under IRB, which is the big governing body for scientific studies. So it's very, you know, tightly guarded, and it's going to be, I think, game-changing for us to truly understand what does it really mean to live with hydrocephalus.
Awesome. I'm going to put my own two cents in about the whole not being able to live independently or living alone. I think, now the study you're referring was 80s, 90s, but I think with the advent of technology, mm-hmm, and just how much technology is changing things, I think it's a very, very far cry. I mean, you've got to be pretty extreme to say somebody can't live independently with supports. So when I say live independently, I mean you're not living with mom and dad. That, yeah, doesn't mean you don't have some kind of supports with you. It just means you're not with mom and dad. And I think there's a lot of people who can live independently if mom and dad are okay with letting go and taking a step back.
Yeah. And I also love, you know, when Gabby was young, she went to a phenomenal school in our area. And the woman who founded it is so inspirational. And she went on to open up Main Street Connect in downtown Rockville, Jillian Copeland and her husband, Scott. And, you know, I think we're going to start to see just more of those kind of mixed living communities too, where there are supports for adults who need support with just within a larger setting. So, I mean, I think you're right. There's so many changes that our kids are going to be able to take advantage of as adults. And it's only going to keep getting better, right? If only the shunt would stay up to date, you know, if only the treatment for hydrocephalus would also get better. There is some fun research being done.
How cool would it be if we could find a way? I mean, you can do bypasses and you can take veins from different parts of your body and reconstruct that. How cool would it be if you had to do a shunt to use a piece of your body already so it's not going to be rejected, so it's not going to be growth over? Because you're using something, maybe there's a way to grow a second vein, and I'm using veins because they're the things I can think of that's a tube that'll carry fluid. But I mean, you know, what if there's just a way of taking that? I mean, come on, we're growing ears on pigs. I mean, there's got to be a way we can do something, you know.
Well, there's also, how about not letting it develop in the first place? How about after a brain bleed and helping the brain repair itself so you don't develop hydrocephalus?
Yeah.
One of the scientists that we funded, it's two women out of Hopkins who went on to receive funding from the National Institutes of Health and from the Department of Defense, are looking at how to help the brain repair itself after a brain bleed. And that doesn't just help hydrocephalus patients, right? It would certainly prevent the development of hydrocephalus. But that also helps anybody who suffers a traumatic brain injury and has a significant brain bleed from the military, you know, to, you know, somebody in a car accident. So, you know, there's so many exciting avenues of research that are happening right now within the field, which never would have been possible had the Hydrocephalus Association not gotten involved.
How can people support the Hydrocephalus Association?
Well, certainly donating, right? We fund a lot of the science that allows for those initial studies to qualify to go on for those multi-million dollar grants. We're not a big organization. We are small, and we are about a $4 million a year, $4.5 million a year organization. We're not Susan G. Komen. We can't give $20 million grants or even $1 million grants right now. But we are very strategic in how we fund our science. And so we have a scientific advisory board and a scientific review committee that looks at our grant cycles and what calls for grants we're putting out there. And it's very strategic. And then when those scientists submit, they then look at the science that's going to have the highest impact over a period of time for a group of people. And so, you know, we're savvy about how we fund these small grants that then set scientists up for those larger grants with NIH. And I just have always been so impressed with how the Hydrocephalus Association manages its research portfolio. So certainly donating is going to help the association, not just with the game-changing research that we are doing, but also allowing us to continue providing resources to families. We provide materials to hospitals all around the country, and we actually have hospitals around the world that have translated our materials for newly diagnosed families so that they know they're not alone, so that they understand the condition. They understand the risks. They know what to look for when their child or their loved one's going to be in trouble and they need to get to a hospital quickly. We couldn't do that without donations. We couldn't distribute those materials. We couldn't publish them. Our website is a wealth of information. It's like an encyclopedia. It probably holds the most information. Now, I can say 100% it holds the most information for the patient community. And we're about to launch a new website, and we have all new sections on living with the condition, including, like, you know, financial considerations, long-term financial planning, education, planning, you know, all different kinds of new sections that are being added to the website. And then it also allows us to continue to provide the one-on-one support we provide. We have a hotline at the association. People call us all the time to learn more, to ask questions, and then to connect with one of our 42 different community networks, which are local support groups all around the country, which are volunteer-led. And we train our volunteers and we support them in being able to bring support to the ground, right? You know, to where people are, host meetings, host get-togethers, so people are not alone. So they know someone else. To watch a kid who's never met another kid with hydrocephalus meet someone, and, you know, they're like six, right? And they're like, oh yeah, where's your shunt? Right, mine's right here. And they're like, you know, and like, look at the two, you know, like they're just living the dream. You know, they're just, it's so, and from that moment on, that child knows that they're not the only one, right? They might be the only one in their grade at school or whatever, but they're not alone. And to see parents, you know, I've had moms cry in my arms because they hadn't talked to anybody or met anybody and nobody understood what they were going through. When you tell somebody my child has this brain condition and they've had X number of brain surgeries, people are like either kind of like a little taken aback and in some ways kind of repulsed a little, like, oh, like untouchable. Is it contagious? Or they're just so overwhelmed by it, they don't know what to say, right? I actually like it when they're more overwhelmed and ask me a bunch of questions because I get to educate someone. For another mom to meet somebody where they don't have to explain it, for me to be like, yeah, I got you. You know, it's a game changer. You know, it's a game changer.
I can't relate, but I think I can understand, both from being widowed and being a military retiree. I mean, I will tell you, I don't talk about my service much. When I meet another veteran, whether we served in the same genre or not, we click. So I know it's not the same thing, Amanda, and I'm not trying to compare.
But it is. It's very similar. It's so similar, Eric. There's stuff you don't have to explain or say. It's just, you get it. People intuitively get it.
Yeah. Now, this has been fantastic. So I want to make sure that I have the three symptoms: wet, wacky, wobbly.
Wet, wacky, and wobbly.
I want to make sure I have a link to the app that you created. I want to make sure I have a link to the website so people can go to the patient registry. I want to make sure they know where to go to donate. And yep. You're doing a walk that you do every year, right? I mean, is the walk almost over? Are you still trying to get people to get involved with the walk?
So we have walks all over the country. Now, this year, they're virtual. The majority of them are virtual. We have a page on our website, hydrosoc.org/walks, where it lists all the different walks all over the country. So we have a big national celebration on September 26th, and everybody's going to be tuning in. It's going to be a big celebration of all of our walks across the country. And that's going to be an hour on September 26th at 3:00. But in addition to that, a lot of local walks are still doing their own thing, where they're bringing their walk teams together, thanking them for the fundraising and the awareness raising, for participating this year in a really challenging year. It's challenging for everybody. You know, certainly COVID-19 has impacted nonprofits incredibly. You know, it's harder for people to give. So people will be celebrating with their local communities too, to really thank them for standing with AJ during this time. So September 26th is the national celebration, but there are walks all over the country and people can find a walk near them and donate to one of the teams that moves them. All of the teams have team pages up, or they can just donate to their local walk. So if you live in Chicago, you know, there's a great Chicago walk, Houston, Dallas, DC. I run the DC walk. So yeah, walks all over the country.
Awesome. And was there anything I should have asked you or that we should have talked about that you want to make sure we touch on?
I think the only thing I would like to leave all of the viewers with is that there are a couple closing thoughts. Is there are a million people in the United States potentially living with hydrocephalus, and their only treatment to manage the fluid and to survive requires brain surgery. And for many of them, it's going to be many brain surgeries over the course of their lifetime. And so because it is an invisible condition, so many people struggle silently living with the condition, either because they just don't want to be grouped into a thought process because they have a chronic medical condition or because they are living with challenges that might not be seen until you really start to get to know them and can appear as annoying or quirky or frustrating, like executive function challenges or ADHD or things like that. And I guess my second parting thought would for everyone, but I don't need to say it here. This is the community that knows it better than anybody, is like, we're all living with something, right? How can we as a group, you know, continue to push for people not judging or having preconceived notions just by what they're seeing on the outside? Because I think inside a lot of us are dealing with a lot of things. And I think this audience is the group that's going to change that in our country. And that's really amazing for me to be here and be able to share it. And AJ does exist to find a cure and to improve the lives of those living with the condition. If you need help, if you're watching this and you need help and you didn't know that we were around, we are, and you're not alone. And please, you know, shoot me an email at the association, give us a call. Get involved locally. And, you know, we are one big community. I love working with all of the other communities in our space, right? You know, I do a lot of work with spina bifida and with autism, with, you know, the Epilepsy Society. You know, we are a strong group of people. And I think we are going to make incredible change over the next 20 years for our loved ones. So
awesome. I have nothing to say to add to that. That's very well said, Amanda.
Drop mic.
On that note, thank you everyone for watching. I will do my best to have this aired by September 26th. If not, just know that it'll be around in the following year and years going on.
Can I give you an incentive, Eric? September is Hydrocephalus Awareness Month.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So you have to have it up.
I will make it a priority.
For the end of September.
I can probably get it. Yeah. Since it's the month, I can probably get it published very, very quickly. So now we're really going to call it quits. Take care, everybody. Thank you for listening to the ABCs of Disability Planning podcast. We invite your feedback and comments. Please feel free to leave a review wherever you are listening. And don't forget to hit like, follow, and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For more information, please visit us at www.specialneedsnavigator.us.